When the little dog belonging to the family started barking ceaselessly, probably sniffing an alien, McGovern decided to give himself up. Barging into the inner rooms, he found the head of the household. It was Sonam, the Tibetan official in charge of the new communication system between India and Tibet. It was Sonam who had given the orders to make a special search for McGovern. Naturally, they both were startled at this unexpected and dramatic meeting. But Sonam behaved handsomely. He arranged a midnight supper, gave McGovern his own comfortable room and planned to inform the Dalai Lama privately the next day of McGovern's arrival. McGovern had to appear before the officials, but he was treated very well. Since it was the custom for two monks from Drepung 123 monastery to take over the administration of Lhasa during the 3 weeks of New Year celebrations, when throngs of fanatical monks and pilgrims come to Lhasa, it was thought advisable for McGovern to remain quietly at Sonam's residence, without venturing into the streets. But he was hardly a prisoner. In his book To Lhasa in Disguise, he describes a mob gathering in the street outside the place where he was staying, throwing stones and sticks and shouting death to the foreigner. As soon as the New Year festival was over and the crowds of monks had departed, he sallied forth on a number of excursions, and on March 24 he was given papers, fresh transport animals, permits for the rest houses and an armed escort to the Indian frontier. It seems a far cry from Arizona to Tibet, but it was not too far for Theo's Bernard. One might have expected Bernard, who was born in Arizona, to have the outlook of a native of one of America's most picturesque western states. But from his parents, who had long followed the religious and philosophical teachings of Asia, he acquired his own interest in Eastern philosophy and spent several years studying in India and Sikkim, with special emphasis on Buddhist teachings. In 1937 he decided to visit Tibet. Like McGovern, he received permission to go to Giants and have his petition to enter Lhasa forwarded to the authorities. At that time the 13th Dalai Lama had been dead several years and the new incarnate Dalai Lama had not yet been found. Bernard stayed several weeks in Giants, combining his interest in monasteries and Lamaism with some of the gay parties that the British organized in those days when they headed the Giants trade mission. The Tibetans were given to understand that Bernard was profoundly interested in learning more about their religion and that he himself was a devotee of yoga practices. After a few weeks, Bernard received his answer, an invitation from the ruling regent and from the 124 Kashag, the high governing body of Lhasa, to visit the capital. Naturally, he was in high spirits. Who wouldn't have been? Bernard was warmly received by Tibetan officials, entertained royally and given handsome presents on his departure. He had visited many monasteries and taken many photographs. On his return to America he went on a number of lecture tours, showing his pictures, and he also gave lessons in yoga. Bernard undoubtedly had a yearning to return to Tibet. Since he did not have a second invitation, he must have planned to enter secretly. Early in November, 1947, dispatches from New Delhi reported that Bernard and his servants had been killed by tribal raiders in the Himalayas. But on November 17 the papers announced that Bernard's American publisher had received a letter from Mrs. Bernard dated November 5 from Calcutta, stating that although tribesmen had killed the carriers, her husband was safe. His present whereabouts was unknown, she said. That was the last word received in this country about the fate of Theo's Bernard. Was he alive? Did he disappear into one of those Tibetan monasteries, which he described, where holy men shut themselves in cave-like grottos for the rest of their lives? It all seemed quite a mystery, a theme for a movie thriller. When we were in Lhasa we inquired about him of some of our Tibetan friends. All of them agreed that Bernard had been killed. The bodies of his servants were found. Although his body was never found, they said he had unquestionably been murdered too. The Tibetans told us that they were amazed and puzzled at the way Bernard kept changing his costume when he was in Lhasa. One day he would wear a Tibetan nobleman's outfit and the next day he would appear in the robes worn by the abbot of a monastery. But what puzzled them most was that when he returned to America he called himself a white lama. 9. In Tibetan homes, At Giants we were about halfway to the capital. CD, here the trade route from India branches off. The main highway continues northeast to Lhasa, and another road turns northwest to Shigatse, Tibet's second city and the seat of the Tashi Lunpo, the Panchen Lama's great monastery. A side trip to Shigatse was a temptation, but the days were slipping by fast. We were eager to forge ahead to have as much time as possible in the holy city of Lamaism. Giants also marks the end of the line as far as Indian and Western influence is concerned. Here the Indian mail service terminates, and very few travelers, except religious pilgrims and Asian traders, are permitted to go farther into Tibet. From Giants to Lhasa there would be no more of those comfortable dak bungalows that had looked so good to us at the end of each day's trek. Now our overnight stops would be made in the homes of Tibetan villagers. After we left Giants we began to enjoy the sensation of being actually in the heart of the world's most remote and secluded country. Any introduction to a Tibetan house is an unforgettable experience. Ours came at the end of the first day's march from Giants at the village of Gobshi. Here we were taken to a tostri stone dwelling. As in most homes in Tibet that are not yokher tents, the ground floor was reserved for caravan animals, plus the owner's yaks, cows, goats and chickens. The usual vicious, snarling mastiff that guards a Tibetan household lunged at us from the end of a yak rope in the courtyard. To reach the living quarters we mounted a rickety ladder which landed us in an upper patio, with dirt-filled rooms on all sides. One was a smoke-filled kitchen with a hole in the roof for a chimney, another, a dark, cell-like compartment with Tibetan Buddhist images surrounded by metal dishes, holding the yak butter lamps that are lighted during devotions. The living quarters were devoid of furniture, except for two low divans and a low red lacquered table in each cubicle. The plumbing? It was of the outdoor variety, a slit in the floor over the manure pile downstairs. It all seemed grim indeed. But it provided shelter from the fierce night winds. Norbu, our cook, immediately made himself at home in the primitive kitchen and prepared supper over two fires of yak dung, with the assistance of our Coleman Foxhole Primus stove that operated on kerosene. Tibetan eyes bulged whenever Norbu used that Primus. Its intense flame seemed to them like some kind of magic. What really was a miracle to me was the fine meal that he concocted in that unlighted, smoke-filled kitchen. He really was an expert chef for an expedition like ours and, besides, he knew all the tricks of Tibetan cooking. Along the kitchen walls the fuel was piled cakes of dung. A young girl was churning butter in a hollow cylindrical wooden tube, about 4 feet high, singing as she worked the plunger up and down. Our Gobshi hosts implored us to use their largest and most elegant room, occupying one side of the patio. Like their Siwong Norbu, the cook, performed miracles over yak dung fires, with the assistance of our Primus stove foxhole type. Here he is preparing dinner in a Tibetan kitchen, where our stove was a fascinating innovation. 129 other rooms, it had a dirt floor, but several tapestries adorned the walls, and the divans at opposite ends of the room were covered with Tibetan rugs. We thanked our hosts and declined the honor, preferring to pitch our tent on the roof and sleep on our own army cots. Next morning we were up at the crack of dawn with the household rooster. We washed in a copper pan and brushed our teeth out of cups, spitting over the edge of the roof. To take care of our other important needs we had to hike out among the rocks. After a breakfast of porridge and eggs, we mounted our ponies and headed on up the gorge for the 18 miles to Ralung. According to his own words put down on the trip, my father enjoyed the meals on the road to Lhasa with as much relish as the most delectable repast prepared by America's exacting gourmet society, if not more. He was, after all, taking his first vacation in many years, and he has a way of extracting the utmost pleasure from his experiences. I must admit that Dad is a better scout than I am. Even though we traveled luxuriously indeed compared to the privations endured by some of the European pioneers who ventured into a very forbidden Tibet, I still insist that our diet was a bit monotonous. I don't want to see another prune or dried apple for years. I quote straight from my father's diary to give you some idea of his reaction to the meals served on the journey to Lhasa. We are sitting in a Tibetan kitchen with 10 other people. In one corner, two women are trying to start a yak dung fire in a stove made of stone and mud. One of the women ones vigorously pushing up and down on a goatskin, a primitive Tibetan bellows. Six others are watching Tsuwong Norbu, as he putters with Lowell Jr.'s stove. The spectators, looking like brigands in a Robin Hood opera, squat around me, drinking the omnipresent Tibetan tea, which is mixed with barley and rancid yak butter. 1-130. These smiling women are engaged in an important domestic task, churning yak butter tea in a wooden cylinder. The ingredients are tea leaves, soda, boiling water, and large chunks of yak butter. The mixture is soupy. A dollar I, old crone and a patriarch are godly eat as the pressure cooker gets going. They can't understand where that intense flame comes from. No doubt they think the Buddha works miracles through strange people. Three more persons have come in. I can hardly make them out through the smoke. Having no chimneys, only holes in the roof, Tibetan kitchens are black and suffocating. They are always on the second floor because the animals, the chickens and the mud are in full possession of the first floor. Thanks to tips from Sui Dam Cutting and to Lowell Jr.'s past experience preparing food in Alaska, with the Dartmouth Outing Club on Mount Washington, and during his recent travels in the back country of Turkey and Persia, we are doing all right on this journey to Lhasa, as far as meals are concerned. Food is the one department in which we shine, and ours is international, too. It has been brought together from practically everywhere. Take breakfast. We start with stewed apple rings from India, or prunes from Australia, or sliced fresh peaches from nearby Bhutan. Next, cream of wheat labeled in many languages and made I don't know where, or porridge of Tibetan barley, or our own American Quaker oats. Then, bread baked on the trail, of Australian self-raising flour, Australian tinned butter specially packed for the tropics, something mysterious, labeled bacon, from Australia, and Tibetan eggs. Our breakfast drink, tea from India. Lunch we always eat on the march, sitting on a pile of rocks, beside one of the tributaries of the Brahmaputra Commodot with peaks from 19,000 to 21,000 feet high circling all around us. Lunch usually consists of water biscuits from England, sardines from Norway, cheese from Switzerland, a block of unsweetened chocolate from England, dates from Persia, and Tibetan snow water, highly chlorinated in case a herd of yak might have been grazing nearby. Seated on Tibetan rugs around a charcoal brazier, by the light of a primitive oil lamp, we usually have quite a feast for dinner. How's this for a menu? A spot of Canadian Club, from General Willoughby, MacArthur's second in command in Tokyo. Then pea soup from Switzerland, concentrated in a block an inch square. Next, ragu dove with gravy from Switzerland or Tibetan mutton, the gift of a Dzongtsik Sen, a district governor, stewed together with fresh turnips, cauliflower, beets and carrots, all local products. Usually W.A. Tilda copyright have a plate of rice from the sack presented to us by another Tibetan official. We top off our banquet with pancakes made with Australian flour and strawberry jam from Tasmania, and klim, our powdered milk from America. It all tastes wonderful, due to the wizardry of cook Tsuwong Norbu, who, to our good fortune, served an Englishman for 7 years in India and Afghanistan. The first two marches out of Giants took us winding upward through a deep gorge. All around us were barren mountains. No trees or flowers grew at this high altitude. But these bleak slopes were obviously rich in iron and other valuable ores. The rock walls were streaked with veins, and the rocks along the trail and under the ponies' hooves looked promising. We were positive that there were quantities of gold in those mountains. We noticed a great abundance of quartz in which several types of minerals were embedded. But sharply as we looked, we could not find any gold nuggets. I was sorry that we could not stop long enough to try panning for stray bits of gold among the sand and pebbles in some of the mountain streams we passed. From time immemorial, Tibetans have washed gold from their streams. Early travelers and later travelers, such as Rockhill and Hedin, have commented on the crude, superficial workings of gold fields in western, northern and eastern Tibet. Unquestionably, the Tibetan Himalayas are an unexplored and virgin source of tremendous mineral wealth, not only gold, but iron, copper, lead, mercury and most likely uranium, too. If the Tibetans would be willing to exploit their mineral deposits, the prosperity and living standards of the country could be greatly increased. But there is a strong feeling against any effective shaft mining for fear of arousing the anger and revenge of the spirits that dwell under the earth. Rockhill, back in 1891, gave an interesting explanation of the prejudice against digging into the earth. Mining is not allowed in Tibet, as there exists a deep-rooted superstition, carefully fostered by the lamas, that if nuggets of gold are removed from the earth, no more gold will be found in the river gravels, the nuggets being the roots or plants whereof the gold dust is the grains or flowers. The superstitions still hold and probably are encouraged by the Tibetan ruling class on the basis that in the process of developing a mining industry, Tibet itself might be exploited and swallowed up by more powerful neighboring countries. We met with the same simple and friendly peasant hospitality in Ralung as in Gobshi, and spent the night in a house of mud and rock similar to our Gobshi shelter. Our animals slept downstairs in a slush of mud. We were taken upstairs, where it was considerably drier. Ralung was even smaller and dingier than Gobshi. From snow peaks a few miles away, a muddy torrent of water rushed past our house. The high point of our stay was Norbu's special treat, a batch of pancakes, made from Australian self-raising flour, served piping hot with butter and strawberry jam. Norbu continued to amaze us with his culinary talent. Again we tried our tent on the roof, but not so successfully as in Gobshi. We almost blew away during the night. The tent tapped wildly, its gyropes snapping against the canvas sides. As if our tent problems were not enough, a group of monks, deciding it was an auspicious night to drive the demons from a nearby hut, beat on drums and blasted their horns of bone without pause. It hardly sounded like music to us, just a terrific racket. We had no sleep that night, but the demon must have been frightened away. The monastery at Ralung is unique. We were told that in this lamasery monks and nuns live together under the same roof. They belong to a sect which permits marriage. It was one big happy family, with many children, all the boys to become monks and the girls destined to be nuns like their parents. Ralung went even a step beyond what we encountered at Giants. On the slope above the town are four Buddhist religious retreats, two for monks, two for nuns. In one monastery and one nunnery, celibacy is strictly observed. In the other two, the discipline is not so demanding and, as a result, many babies are dedicated to the service of Buddha. But Ralung and Giants are exceptions. The majority of Tibetan lamasaries impose vows of celibacy on their members. On our 17th day out of Gangtok, capital of Sikkim, we started from Ralung on our longest day's march, 32 miles. In a car at home, that distance would take about 45 minutes. But 32 miles across Tibet on the road to Lhasa is another matter. It took our caravan 14 hours. On the first 8 miles from Ralung, we rode rapidly down a wide, lonely valley, not a sign of life except an occasional caravan. Then we began to climb through a gorge between cliffs rich in iron and other minerals. For hours in a pouring rain, we mounted steadily toward the Karola, between giant mountains from which glaciers sent their waters cascading towards one of the many tributaries of the Brahmaputra. Near the summit of the Karola, a 16,600-foot pass, we were squeezed in between three great glaciers, walls of ice only a few yards from our stone-it rail. After scaling the Karola, we collided on the other side with the longest caravan of yaks we had met on our whole 138. Near the pass we met a caravan of yaks. At some narrow places on the Tibetan trails, a collision of two caravans would be disastrous, and to avoid this danger the animals wear bells to warn travelers approaching. Journey. Either our string of pack animals or the yaks had to give way. The trail was not wide enough for both. So the Chogpan, our military escort, drove those hundreds of yaks over the edge with his whip and at a precipitous place, too. But the yak is an incredible animal. In spite of his size, he can cling to a mountain wall with his cloven hooves where no horse or mule would venture. A little farther on we had to detour around a place where an avalanche of snow from a mountain peak had completely wiped out our trail. Just over the pass we stopped at an inn frequented by yak herdsmen to dry ourselves out and have a comforting cup of tea. It was the dirtiest and smokiest hovel we had stumbled into, and we had seen plenty. Even the muleteers objected to spending the night in that dump. Still rubbing our eyes from the smoke in the hut, we pushed off in the rain for another 16 miles. "You know," remarked Dad, as we rode along, "I believe the Swai Dam cuttings stayed a night at that inn when they were in Tibet." "Well, I don't envy them the experience," I said. "I'm afraid those dak bungalows spoiled us and we're getting a little soft," Dad observed. "We're traveling very deluxe. Do you remember how Madame David Neal made her way to Lhasa?" Of course I remembered. She was the first Western woman to reach the Forbidden City. She came there uninvited and in disguise, and she lived in Lhasa for 2 months without being discovered. That was in 1925. No one ever set forth so well equipped to undertake a journey in disguise to Lhasa as this remarkable French woman, Alexandra David Neal. A student of Sanskrit and Oriental philosophies and religions, she already knew something of Tibetan literature and the Tibetan language. In Burma, Nepal, China, Japan and Korea she had studied and meditated in famous monasteries. For a time she lived in 140, an old-timer spins his prayer wheel with one hand and tells his beads with the other, in preparation for a happy reincarnation. The Tibetan rosary has 108 beads, one for each book of the Buddhist scriptures. 141, Sikkim, and legally adopted as her son a young Tibetan boy who was later ordained as a Lama and known as Yongden Lama. On one of her journeys to Tibet she succeeded in penetrating as far as Shigatse, where the Panchen Lama, the one who fled to China and died there in exile in 1937, showered her with attention when he recognized her zeal and interest in the study of Lamaism. Although the Panchen Lama was eager to help Madame David Neal in her researches in every way and pressed her to make an extended stay, it was not long before the Lhasa authorities ordered her to leave the country. She had not been officially invited. This enforced departure, combined with the fines poor villagers in the neighborhood of Shigatse had to pay for not reporting her, rankled bitterly. She said, "I must confess that, unlike most travelers who have attempted to reach Lhasa and have failed to reach their goal, I never entertained a strong desire to visit the sacred Lamaist city. As for my researches regarding the literature, philosophy and secret lore of Tibet, these things could be pursued more profitably among the literati and mystics in the freely accessible and more intellectual parts of northeastern Tibet than in the capital. What decided me to go to Lhasa was, above all, the absurd prohibition which closes Tibet." Madame David Neal did not concern herself with politics, but she felt strongly that Tibet should not be closed to explorers, scientists, scholars and other honest and well-meaning travelers. It was her strong conviction that the British were wholly responsible for the situation. A few years after her Shigatse experience, she set out with her adopted son and one servant from Jakyendo, a market town on the Lhasa Road, with the intention of making an 18-month journey through Tibet. As she was nearing the Salween River, she was stopped and again was ordered out of the country. This time she was determined to take action. "TT was then," she wrote in her introduction to my journey to Lhasa, "that the idea of visiting Lhasa really became implanted in my mind. Before the frontier post to which I had been escorted, I took an oath that in spite of all obstacles I would reach Lhasa and show what the will of the woman could achieve. But I did not think only of avenging my own defeats. I wanted the right to exhort others to pull down the antiquated barriers which surround, in the center of Asia, a vast area extending approximately from 79 to GG degrees longitude." As a professed Buddhist of the ascetic type, Madame David Neal was always able to gain the confidence of scholarly lamas. Writing, Understanding and speaking fluently many Tibetan dialects, she could in a good disguise pass at least for a pilgrim from one of the Buddhist regions bordering on Tibet. With her love of humor and lively interest in people, her courage and willingness to meet every obstacle, she was ready to set forth and show what the will of a woman could achieve. So on Madame David Neal's fifth journey into Tibet, Lhasa was her definite goal. Starting out in the early autumn with Yongdan through the frontier section, which was under Chinese rule, she went by way of Likiang, crossing the Salween River into the heart of Tibet. They took on the roles of poor religious pilgrims partly begging their way. Yongdan, as a lama of the Red Hat sect, wore the robes of his order, but very shabby ones. Madame David Neal, in even shabbier Tibetan dress, traveled as his aged mother. She dyed her brown hair with black Chinese ink, which often had to be renewed, and lengthened it by adding jet black yak's hair. As a finishing touch, she powdered her face with a mixture of cocoa and crushed charcoal. Under their clothes they concealed money belts and revolvers to meet any emergency. They had no carriers with them. Alone and carrying heavy loads on their backs, they walked all the way to Lhasa at night and concealed themselves in caves or behind rocks during the daytime. They lived on a scanty diet of buttered tea and samba, but many times they went 24 hours and longer without any food. As the weather grew more severe and they had to scale the high snow passes, they often slept in the open on the snow with their little tent wrapped around them. They carried no blankets, and the tent usually served as their only protection against the bitter cold. They dared not put it up until they got farther into the country. Realizing that they really passed as mendicant pilgrims with the Tibetans, they gained more confidence in their disguise, and no longer tried to detour around villages. Sometimes they begged for shelter in a peasant hut and sat and slept on rough kitchen floors filthy with grease from soup, butter and other muck. Sometimes Yongdan bought food supplies at a monastery, leaving his poor old mother to wait outside. As a Red Hat, Yongdan was often pressed to tell fortunes and indicate where a lost cow was or whether a lawsuit would turn out successfully, all matters which he handled with great discretion. Madame David Neal, tied to a hook, had to swing across rivers above high gorges on sagging leather cables. She and her adopted son were snowblocked for several days on a high pass in a blizzard and almost starved before they worked their way down. They had an auto escape from robbers. But always she kept her sense of humor and, ignoring the many risks and hardships, she viewed the whole experience as a glorious adventure and a rare opportunity to get close to the lives of the poor, everyday folk of Tibet. Her only fear was that she might be discovered before she reached Lhasa. Disguised as pious beggars, they frequently had to solicit food and alms to avoid suspicion. But when they felt safe in the heart of Tibet, they purchased supplies, sometimes being extravagant beggars, as Madame David Neal expressed it, indulging in molasses cakes, dried fruits and plenty of butter. It was the most economical journey she had ever taken. During the 4 months' walk from Yunnan to Lhasa, the two of them succeeded in spending only 100 rupees. They slipped unnoticed into Lhasa with the great throngs arriving for the New Year festivals. Finding lodgings in a hovel occupied by poor beggars, they felt that their incognito was safe. After their long, hard journey on foot, Madame David Neal was determined to reap her reward by attending all the festivals and viewing all the sights of the holy city. And during a 2 month stay she visited everything from the Potala to the Butter Festival. As one of the Tibetan tourist crowd, she was usually taken for a Ladakhi and, rather gloating over her talent as an actress, she even put on a show in the marketplace, bargaining for an aluminium saucepan at a ridiculous price, talking nonsense and making the more sophisticated Lhasa shoppers laugh at the peasant woman who came from the cattle and grass country. That act was really a triumph, because she pulled it when she saw a policeman eyeing her intently and suspiciously. She left Lhasa as quietly as she had come, but she and Yongdan set out in comfort as middle-class Tibetans on ponies, with carriers. It did not matter now if they were caught. Since they were on their way from, instead of to, Lhasa, no one paid much attention to them. At Giants she called on David MacDonald, the part Tibetan British trade agent, and astonished him and his colleagues with a brief account of her adventures and her undiscovered visits to Lhasa.